Welcome to All In, the Sustainable Business Podcast. Three veterans of sustainability, David Grayson, Chris Coulter, and Mark Lee, take you behind the scenes of the most innovative and exciting aspects of business today.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this All In, the Sustainable Business Podcast episode. I'm Chris Coulter, and I'm joined with David Grayson and Mark Lee. Hey, David, how are you today?
I'm very good, Chris. Mark, nice to see you both.
Great to see the both of you, as always. Glad to be here, Chris and David, too.
Yeah, so this is one of our, what we call our banter sessions, where we don't have a guest, so it's just the three amigos here, for better or for worse, to try and sort through a little bit of where we're at on the sustainability agenda these days. And lots of swirl, lots of events, lots of stuff happening, and we thought we would just reflect collectively on where things are at. And one of the maybe the interesting pieces we can bring into the conversation is at GlobeScan, we did a flash poll of U.S. consumers. It was a public opinion study, 1,000 Americans that we surveyed in late March. So just, you know, about a couple weeks ago. And it was an update to our August 2024 survey on the sustainability agenda. So we wanted to see in this context of lots of events, lots of conversation around sustainability, particularly in the U.S., what is happening with public opinion? And to our surprise, it is remarkably stable. And that's really interesting that the American public, despite all the conversations related to the climate agenda, the green agenda, DE&I, all the politics, all the economic context and anxiety related to potential inflation and consumer confidence waning, we see a very strong consistency of Americans being concerned about the sustainability agenda, seeing expectations for companies to continue in the same degree it has been for the last decade, in expectations for companies to speak out about issues like climate and even DE&I. And we put that in very specifically to see how that played, as well as some consumer increases a little bit in self-reported purchasing of sustainable products, all in that context of people thought. And the noise to signal, I think, is important, because I think many assumptions were that things had declined or consumers were less engaged on sustainability than they are in the U.S. But lo and behold, there's a resiliency in public opinion. That's an important foundation. But David, any thoughts or reflections or surprises from the research from your vantage point?
Well, to use a good academic term, I was rather gobsmacked by the research, because I anticipated we would have seen much more of a cratering of US consumers when it came to questions about should companies still be taking action on climate, etc. And particularly, as you said, Chris, still remarkably resilient, apparently, in terms of expecting that business leaders should be speaking out on some of these topics, which in some of the current context and some of the recent news developments out of the States, you think, wow, that's really very surprising.
Yeah, it is surprising. And I think it is very counter to expectations of what the vibe would be with business communities. But the underpinning of what their consumers and constituents and employees are all expecting is more voice, more clarity on what they stand for, what they do. And of course, business has gone very quiet. Mark, what's your take on the research?
Yeah, I want to come in, Chris, with a thought, and I just wanted to ask you a question first as to how parallel this research on the U.S. consumer was to anything recent you've got on consumers in other regions. Are things running at anything like a par, or is there still a gap between what consumers in this most consumer-driven economy are thinking? What is the global landscape in comparison?
Yeah, it's a good question. So some other work we do with clients in a proprietary way does show good consistency from last year on both the issue agenda and the role of business, and also some of the challenges that consumers continue to have when it comes to, you know, shopping with their dollars or engaging, is that they think it's too expensive, it's challenging, and there's not enough supply of options. So all of that is pretty consistent. Which I think is important, because I think as you both know, when talking, a lot of people in the sustainability community are pretty back-footed. They're feeling under attack in some cases, that we've lost momentum. And yet, if the public, which is, I think, the fountainhead for everything in society in the long run, and if the public does continue to feel the same ways it did a couple of years ago when we're at a much more heyday orientation around sustainability, it's encouraging. It could flip back again very quickly, and those public opinion values, attitudes, behaviors could translate into opportunities for sustainability going forward.
Yeah, I'm thinking about connections, Chris, and you referenced briefly that this survey's come out at the same time as we've been watching things like the University of Michigan consumer sentiment survey just crater, right? And so it seems like there's this potential disconnect between what consumers have said, especially self-reporting they're out buying more sustainable product, and what they might do. But it has me just turning in my head a question about whether what we would consider to be household, kitchen table, economic issues are now more overlapped with sustainability issues. So energy and the price of it matters to every household, and renewable energy supply has been growing incredibly rapidly and proving that it is as reliable and cheaper than traditional forms of. So are there these little points where preferred sustainability solutions overlap traditional economic issues? And if households are also concerned about inflation and the cost of food and certainly the availability of housing from a social perspective, and about the impacts of weather and climate that people now in considerable majorities, US included, your research also included, say, yes, I've been affected, or I know people have been affected. Do these things start to blur? And is that why that expectation remains, that if, or especially if, the governments that I look to for some leadership on this maybe aren't delivering in the same way right now, it's all the more important that the companies where I spend my dollar do something. And that's, you know, me rambling, speculating, but it seems like possible points of connection.
Yeah, I think there's good hypotheses in all of what you said, Mark. I think the challenge with consumers, and well, let's be a little bit specific so we have a sense of, so the continuity, I mean, when we ask how much have you been affected by cost of living, 61% of Americans have been greatly personally affected by cost of living. That's very consistent to August 2024. When it comes to how much have you been impacted by climate change, it's 31%. So a 30-point delta, which is exactly the same as it was in August 2024. So there is that people have factored into the challenge of the market for consumers and cost of living. So that is consistent. And despite that, it hasn't dented concern or engagement on sustainability issues. When it comes to purchasing, we now have 49% of Americans, that's up 6 points, who said, yes, I've purchased a sustainable product in the past month. And when we looked at that, that really means food products, personal care, cleaning products. It's these things you buy on a frequent basis that are, mm-hmm. are more visible. And that market for consumers is clear. Like, energy is hard for, I think, consumers to discern. We buy it in different ways. And then bigger purchase items are also more random. And this is in the last month. So it's meant to be, what's your quotidian sort of expression on this? And the last point, among those who didn't buy but wanted to, the reason why they said they didn't buy a sustainable product was half people said it's because it's too expensive. So
what's price? Yeah.
So it is connected to the cost of living a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, not only do I find it interesting, there's something in there that I find heartening, and it'll be really, really worth watching this data and similar, I think, through the course of this year, if it continues to be such an uncertain policy environment, if some of the kind of specter of potential recession or return of inflation turn out to be true, then understanding what is going on with the public and the consumer, which, as you said, is kind of the underlying bedrock of so much of it or all of it, will be essential for us to understand from a sustainability perspective and more widely.
Yeah, I think that's right, particularly because certainly from a European perspective, the view is that at the moment there is a lot of both consumer and voter concern about what is perceived as the costs of making the transition, for example, to renewable energy. And some of the more populist political parties across Europe are making a great play on this point about it's too expensive to make the transition to more renewable energy. So this is feels a little bit counterintuitive to some of the things we're seeing in the European political debate at the moment.
And some of that seems to be playing through in perceptions of European governmental leaders of Europe's competitiveness and the need to look incredibly closely at the costs associated with both maintaining kind of European economic competitiveness overall and making the sustainability transition. And so, you know, writ large, omnibus. And whether it's possible to kind of simultaneously simplify, streamline, clean up that guidance while maintaining high enough standards for sustainability, but not impacting Europe's competitiveness negatively, which I think is the fear connected to much of what you just said, David.
Now, I know we have a very informed listenership for our podcast, but perhaps that very shorthanding, Mark, that you just did on omnibus, maybe for anybody in the sustainability world around the world who's not actually been following all of the ins and outs of the last few months in relation to EU legislation, maybe just a quick 1 minute burst on what we
omnibus doesn't lend itself to 1 minute bursts, David. That's completely ridiculous.
Nothing out of Brussels would be a 1 minute synopsis.
But the omnibus proposal has come out, and it addresses four key pieces of existing European legislation: the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive, the EU Taxonomy Regulation, and the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism Regulation, which has the best acronym of the four of them in being CBAM. So go bam, ooh, bam, bam. Across the board, the questions that are being raised in the proposal are the number of companies that should need to comply, and that looks like it will reduce to fewer larger companies, and the timing on which they'll be required to come into line with these things. And subsequent to the actual omnibus proposal coming out, which was February, we've gone through another gateway already on Stop the Clock, which officially backed up the timelines for compliance. So, you know, Europe's kind of recalibrating. I don't think it's recalibrating whether it wants to lead. And David, I'd be very interested in your closer perspective, because that's part of it. You know, some people are saying like this is a step back and a giving up, and I don't believe that. I think it's recalibrating how the pace at which, how to balance this. And of course, in the Europe of 2025, like this is also a Europe in which issues not just of economic security, but literal physical security of countries are so shadowed by the war in Ukraine and everything that goes with that. And now the tariff war between the US and Europe, and these are trying times economically, socially, and otherwise. And this sustainability agenda that we talk about is finding its path amidst all these other massive pressures.
That was a masterly summary in just over a minute. Thank you. I agree with you. I think it would be completely unrealistic if, in the face of all of the challenges facing the European Union right now, and you've summarized those clearly, that the Union tried to proceed as was. And I think when the dust settles a little bit, there will be some important learning about the way in which some of the detail of what is now caught up in this omnibus proposal, particularly around, for instance, the lack of alignment between the due diligence directive in terms of what you should be doing in terms of checking on what's happening in your supply chain, and lack of alignment with the reporting directive, and also that it needed much greater involvement in that development process from businesses who had actually been in the lead. One of the arguments I've used for years for why businesses should go ahead of legal requirements is because then they have a much greater legitimate argument for having a seat at the table when subsequently new legislation is being considered. And I think there's some important lessons for the future in terms of perhaps on this occasion there wasn't as much involvement, which is strange because historically in a whole series of these areas, the European institutions have had a pretty good track record in terms of multi-stakeholder engagement and consultation. But that's for another day. I think that kind of lessons to be learnt for the future.
Yeah. And I do think it's like anything, you try something and the regulation is quite onerous. And the feedback, I think, has been quite clear from business in particular. It's too much, you know, but and then it's time to recalibrate, as you're saying, Mark, or to tweak. But, you know, I think gaps between bureaucrats and business sometimes, and there's not homogeneity in either of those pockets. So who knows? But it does speak to the point, I think, to the, again, a drum banging on a drum, but why the political conversations sometimes are divorced from what society wants and expects. And sometimes we assume if the political conversation is going one direction, it must be mirrored by public shifts. And we're not, again, in the US, we're not seeing any shifts like that. And in fact, a bit of movement towards maybe even beginning to shop and express values in business and the marketplace more so, because there's another stat that said a 5-point increase in people thinking that public protest is actually a good way to make change. And we see that especially with younger generations. Okay, so in this context of all this, there's other movement that we've been seeing too this week that are important to note and maybe kind of reflective of some of the vibes and the changes that are happening in corporate sustainability broadly. But in the Net Zero Banking Alliance made a announcement that they're shifting the requirements to be a part of it. And this is based on a lot of pressure and some banks that pulled out of the NZBA over the last couple of years. And so it's been, so they've tried to recalibrate again something. But Mark, what's your take on, and maybe you can describe a little bit what's happened and what's your sense of, is it a good or a bad or a neutral change?
Yeah, I think a few things, and there's an arc of activity that's been happening over a few months, right? I think it was right at the end of 2025, maybe right at the start of, or sorry, end of 2024, maybe right at the start of this year or both, a considerable number of really influential financial institutions left the alliance. And so trouble's afoot kind of thing, right? If key big global banks, financial institutions won't stay in, then an alliance like that can't do what it purported to do. And it was notable that a good number of those were US. And so the alliance has come out now with kind of a restatement of how it's structuring its goals, or maybe more appropriately, moving away from goals. As I interpret it, partly thanks to the FT and other media analysis, you know, the Net Zero Banking Alliance is shifting away from the specifics of goals to assessing and promoting implementation. And from the question of like, just are you defunding fossil fuel activity to how much are you putting into renewables activity? There's a potential slippery slope here that's uncomfortable, right? Like for sure, let's be honest about that. And I think the pursuit of goals and ambitions wasn't working. And that we've had a broad lesson about that in recent years that, you know, maybe from Paris, maybe from the original Rio conference, you know, kind of pick your starting point. We broadly, governments, companies, et cetera, have been great at setting goals in the sustainability context and much less good at delivering against them. So in principle, the Net Zero Banking Alliance making a shift from goals to implementation to me sounds like it's right for the time. Maybe it's overdue for the time. But the goals do remain important. And there are some sort of absolute targets here. And the language seems to be, you know, yes, we're going to keep 1.5 degrees in sight, but we're not going to just bang the drum on that number. We're going to keep asking members of the alliance what they're doing to implement better, more climate friendly lending, investment, et cetera. And I think other organizations, alliances, financial and other, are going through a similar moment. And that individual companies, if you take it right down there, this goes back to like the Unilever restatement of sustainability plan that we mm-hmm. talked about on the podcast last year mm-hmm. and others. I think there is a good shift in that to try to narrow to the truly most material issues for individual organizations, that pursuing the broadest set of goals wasn't working. And then if we can get companies to lean in where they can actually have the most impact and influence, which means it's got to be somehow quantifiable in at least many more cases, it's got to directly contribute to their competitiveness. It can't just be nice. It can't be benevolent. We see under economic pressure how fast benevolent disappears. And so I'm all for applauding the nice gestures when times are good and people can afford it. And, you know, there's a CEO there who cares about some particular issue, but it's not what I rely on. You know, I want to see energy companies invest in cleaner energy. I want to see mining companies take care of their fence line communities and get minerals out of the ground more efficiently and cleanly. And if that's where sustainability focuses, all the way from alliances down to individual organizations, then I think good. I think we're in the midst of an uncomfortable shift on that right now. We can't say we're at good, but at least that's possible. I'm really curious what the two of you think.
Yes. So I think we're facing so many different geopolitical global challenges. And we are obviously in a time of is it polycrisis, permacrisis, take your pick. And in response to that, I think we are starting to see some thoughtful individuals and groups recognizing that not everything that we've been trying over the last few years has actually worked out in the way that it was hoped for a few years ago. There's been whole areas that have not really been yet addressed and yet are absolutely fundamental. So last autumn, for instance, we had the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership come out with an important statement about the need to rethink the approach that individual companies and businesses generally were taking towards sustainability, particularly their engagement with governments, with international institutions like the European Union and so on. And of course, we're having Lindsay from CISL join us in one of our next podcast episodes very, very shortly to talk.
That'll be exciting.
In more detail. Yeah. And that's going to be, I know, a really great discussion. And in similar vein, I was struck just this last few days reading a new paper that's come out from System IQ, Jeremy Oppenheim. They apparently have been doing something called the Blue Whale Inquiry, essentially they've been talking to a group of international thinkers, practitioners in the broad areas of sustainable development and asking what really needs to change. And the paper, it's a very short paper, just 14 pages, that has emerged from that is not
that's short for you, David. A little long for Mark and I, but yeah, keep going.
It's a very short 14 pages, and it's certainly not their last word on the topics, but a bit of a stake in the ground, I think, presumably to provoke some wider debate. And one of the things in there that really caught my eye, and which I just instinctively agreed with, was first of all the recognition, and it's something I think that Paul Polman said in one of his recent posts on LinkedIn as well, about the fact that we're doing a lot of good stuff on the substance, but we aren't really anywhere near good enough at making the compelling case, getting the story right. And in this shock therapy paper from Jeremy Oppenheim, the first thing he talks about is that the language that we use between us and in these podcasts, we use with many of our guests, is inevitably a bit of an in language. And it's not speaking to the concerns and the aspirations of voters and consumers. And I like some of the suggestions that he makes very, very briefly in terms of repositioning a lot of the what we would call the sustainable development agenda away from terms like the just transition and so on, to one which is much more based on the better outcomes that a more sustainable future can have for people in terms of cleaner air, in terms of better health, of better food, etc., of more reliable cheaper sources of long-term energy and so on. The kind of the building blocks of home and community in place that most people spend their time is thinking and worrying about, not the future of the planet, the future of international relations, etc. So I personally am excited that there's more debate now, hopefully starting, about in the face of all these challenges, how are we going to respond to it? Yes, we know we've got lots of problems. Yes, things are, in many respects, are not good today. But it's no point in just being all doom and gloom. I think the onus is then, if we feel that things are bad, in some respects going in entirely wrong direction, then the onus is on active citizens to come up with better solutions that appeal and resonate. That's called democracy.
Yes, well, there is good positive stuff, but there is doom and gloom for sure. It's not sugarcoated. There was a great article in the FT today by the amazing Israeli historian Yuval Noah Harari, where he talks about, you know, the geopolitics. But the one line that is the killer is that if we continue down this, you know, what he calls the fortress world, the ultimate results will be global war, ecological collapse, and out of control AI. So that's good to put in perspective. This is just from, you know, some, you know, Nobel Prize winning historian who knows nothing about civilization. But anyway.
Absolutely. And it's a really important article, and I don't disagree with it at all. Yeah. But having said, you know, so I think good leadership is about being brutally honest about where you are today, but then also offers a credible, coherent plan to get to a better tomorrow. And then what's your part in contributing?
Totally. And from Paul Pullman's article, it's called We're Winning the Fundamentals, but Still Losing the Plot. And just like in the Jeremy article, and I think in the Mission 2025 work that's been going on, a lot of it gets to communications. Interesting. Like it's, and I worry about that being not substantive enough, but I think it is part of it. But Paul has this great line in his article: markets respond to signals, but people, employees, investors, customers, respond to stories. The stories we believe will dictate whether we move with confidence or with one foot on the brake. And I think he's true. And so how do we change the stories? In the Mission 2025, if people have seen it, there's also a great, they've got a great piece where, you know, it's about living rooms, as you were saying, David. What do normal people talk about? What do they care about? It's about boardrooms, which is more about materiality than morality. And there's those cabinet rooms, which I think increasingly is economic security, resilience that matter. So I think that we do, and we kind of do that in the sustainability world. We're very good at shifting and translating, but we could always be better and sharpen it. But go ahead, Mark, you're going to jump in.
Yeah, no, lots of nodding while the two of you have been talking. I think the risk that you cite, Chris, that it somehow boils down to communication, that's there. But I think narrative and stories really do matter. Mm-hmm. They engage. And mm-hmm. You said something years ago, I don't know if you'll remember, it just made me laugh at the time, and it stuck for me in the context of this, which is, you know, when people buy a charter beach vacation, they buy it based on the photos of the beach, not photos of the plane. Right. And the ride they'll have on the way. And sometimes this is very muddled, but, you know, sometimes the sustainability messaging is all about the climate change doomsday scenario we are in, rather than the better life people might enjoy on the other side of the clean transition. And I'm defaulting into some of the language David's telling me to avoid about clean transition and it's hard. but I think too, if we look at the sort of history of sustainable products and green consumption, the ones that have worked and endured are products that are better. Right? Like you're going to have a little enclave of people who will buy something purely because it is, you know, deeply more sustainable somehow in its sourcing or its environmental performance at point of end of life or whatever. But sustainable products that succeed are better. And I think we do see that with the growth of renewables
and different
over time.
I think in our regeneration roadmap years ago, Mark, you came up with that framework, right? Like what is better? What is mm-hmm. different from mm-hmm. an impact perspective and better? And those two things have to combine, which I think is a good thing to remember.
Yeah, it's got to be catching. It's got to be inspiring. It's got to be motivating. And it's got to deliver, right? It's actually got to make things be better, more enjoyable, safer, healthier, accessible. That's where the air and price matters. Everything, it's got to come in. And so it's a big challenge. But the narrative and the story that drives that is incredibly important. And it's not always been what our field's been best at. So it sounds like the Jeremy challenge in that regard from Systemic is on point.
Well, maybe we can bring it to a contemporary thing that's happening here in Canada. So the Net Zero Banking Alliance was started by Mark Carney, in Glasgow, and now he's the Prime Minister of Canada, and he is 10 or 9 days away from potentially being elected with a mandate to be Prime Minister. The polls suggest that he will, but the debates were this week in French and English, and it was interesting to see someone who we know understands the issue and the macroeconomic context and how these things fit in, and did a really remarkable initiative with the NZBA, and it's got wobbly, but it was very, very ambitious, as we know. And so here he is on stage in the debates being asked about pipelines, and his whole ethos in this is, strong Canada in response to the tariffs and the threats from the Trump administration, but also being this builder, and we're going to build houses, we're going to build energy. And he's been very careful to say, we're building everything, which could include fossil fuel pipelines, but will definitely include lots of green energy too. And he's just gone on to rather than parsing these things, it's like, let's build everything and be more dynamic and with a growth, and I think a subliminal economic security message. So it's interesting. He's not saying no to fossil fuels, but he's saying yes to a lot of the accessible, positive green energy solutions that could be existing. Any thoughts that either of you have on how someone from our world to a degree has come into, popular politics? David?
And David, I'm happy to jump in. I thought you might be leaning in with all your policy background and bona fides, so you'll have to follow me. I'm really fascinated by this, Chris. I think the notion that a G7 country, it is being led now by a Mark Carney, but to win the electoral mandate will be different, right? Because if folks haven't been following this from outside Canada, he has succeeded Justin Trudeau as the leader of the Liberal Party, which automatically made him prime minister, but he hasn't yet won his own electoral mandate. So April 28th, we find out if he gets to form a government. And especially when you look at the trend in elections of the last few years and a kind of stepping back from some of the sustainability agenda, Carney represents something different. And as the, lead central banker in Canada and then in the UK, the only person who's done that in two nations, the only non-Brit who's ever been the head of the Bank of England, he looked out at climate and sustainability issues, but climate and nature especially, and said, this is an economic threat. And it's kind of become the platform he's operated on since. So when he talks about build, I think he means build in a way that's resilient. Mm-hmm. And still got to deliver what everybody needs now in terms of households and the issues that Canadians care about, which are very similar to those mirrored through other nations in polling. So a politician and a leader has to be able to deliver across the board, but I think his commitment is in the how to do it and how to address the threats and the opportunities that climate and nature bring to the table at the same time. If he wins this election, which it looks kind of likely that he will now, I think it's a really remarkable outcome in 2025.
And to combine that with the president of Mexico being an esteemed climate scientist in her own right, the president of Iceland, who's a friend of ours, Hala, who was a part of the B team running that important powerhouse of a country. But there are these things that do. Yeah. It is like, it's not all one story. It's go ahead, David. What are you going to say?
No, I'm not really going to have much to add to you two Canadians on the connection.
We share the same king, the same. So you've got every right. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely part of the Commonwealth. But I think it's exciting that there is a candidate for the most senior political office in one of the G7 countries who has a broader hinterland than being just a professional politician and can bring the breadth of expertise of having done the jobs that Mark reminds us of. So it will be interesting to see. By the time the podcast is published, we will know the result.
Well, we'll predict. All of this, Mark, we should also remind listeners that we are embarking on a shared research project with John Elkington and Volans that will be a public good, we hope, where we're going to survey sustainability-oriented stakeholders across the world on what we're calling the crossroads of sustainability. Which direction do we go to 2030? And it's a pretty involved survey. So this consultation is really important because I think hopefully it'll you know give us a collective perspective on what's working and what isn't and where do we place our best bets going forward. So we hope that check out our LinkedIn pages and you'll see a notification of how to participate in that survey. But we really hope people participate and then use it all collectively as a way to provoke our thinking and sharpen our engagements.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. And this is a reframing of our of the leadership survey, the sustainability leadership survey our organizations have done together for years and years. And the GlobeScan originated on its own even longer ago, pushing 30 years, Chris. We'll have to think about that anniversary. And Boland's in this year as a partner, using it as an opportunity to really kind of take stock, as Chris said, in this moment, like mid-decade, where are we on the agenda? Which things work best, like an honest assessment of the tools and resources that are available to all of us who work in this space to move the agenda faster, to scale it to a greater degree. We hope it will produce some really practical and applicable information and also motivate people to do more at a time when doing more is just needed.
I've been a great fan, as you know, of this survey for years. And I think the fact that you're now expanding and hopefully deepening also what it's going to cover. It's part of this debate. We've referenced the CISL paper. We've referenced the paper from Jeremy Oppenheim, shock therapy, and so on. And this is all part, I think, of this debate about, so what's working, what's not working, what can we build on?
Well, thank you. Thanks, gentlemen. And it was great to have this conversation. I hope listeners enjoyed it. If you did, please share it and give us a positive rating if you can, and give us some feedback on via our LinkedIn pages. We're happy to hear how we can do better and provide different perspectives. And otherwise, I wish you both a wonderful weekend.
And you. Thanks, everyone.
Take care.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the All In Podcast. If so, don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss any future episodes. And why not also give us a 5-star review on iTunes? It helps others to find us, which helps spread the message.